This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Sarah, let's start at the very beginning. Has writing always been a part of your life?
Yes, it has. Well, I think it's more that like reading has always been a part of my life. And then I was always kind of trying to, capture that feeling of being moved by the writing. I'm always like a little suspicious of people that like chart their career back to like when they were 7 or 8 years old. I just think it's like a bit silly. I did have a thing a few years ago with Jenny Acklin where a couple writers kind of brought their childhood diaries. And mine was not unlike the notebooks that I currently use for work, where I had my spy diary and I would go around making observations about the neighborhood and the neighbors, and very little has changed except now I get paid for that. So I was always kind of doing stuff like that, but also stories and, you know, poetry and all the rest. And when I went to uni and became a lawyer, I kind of deliberately chose positions that allowed me to hive off writing time. For my own purposes, mostly not at work. Now mine, I might pause.
And do you remember the first thing that you ever had published?
Yes. I mean, the first kind of creative work that I had published, because I had been publishing kind of legal academic work, and legal-based opinion pieces. But I mean, none of that was kind of as meaningful as the first creative work that I published, which was a poem. So I think it was two kind of very close. One was in like a New York lit journal, and one...
Oh my God, that's like an incredible first creative piece to be published.
But it was so weird because I kind of had been like... it's not like secretly doing it, but privately doing it. And then that kind of first time when you're like, oh, maybe I'll submit something. And then it suddenly becomes a different endeavor altogether. I mean, I don't know how it was for you, but there's something kind of very private about, it's like showing someone your laundry. I don't know. I feel like it was a very weird thing to do, but I'm happy that I stepped out there.
I want to come back to that kind of theme of vulnerability a little later. But if we flash forward and look at your books, both very different books, but similarities in some ways. And I think a key way is the way that you build relationships with the people that you write about. I'm very curious as to how this works. So if you see someone or a group that you're interested in, what do you do?
I like the question. It like assumes that I have a process, because I have this academic background and I have a legal background, it's a constant disappointment to myself that I don't have the same like replicable process and I should have. Like when I went on mat leave, both times I wrote handover notes to myself about how I do my job. But it is much more intuitive. And unfortunately, with factual writing, when you write about people, the nature of that is that the approach is bespoke each time. It really depends on the context and the person. But generally, I mean, to the degree that I can make like a general observation about how I do it. It's been different each time. So if it's someone that I meet like in the world and I know.
I guess how quickly do you disclose is part of my question is how quickly do you say, oh, I'm a writer and I'm interested in you to write about? Like that's a particular frame.
Oh yeah,
for a relationship.
That's pretty much my first sentence. And I think crucial to the practice of narrative nonfiction when you're writing about people, like that's who I am. I'm not like, there's no big reveal. I don't cultivate relationships and then like suddenly be like, aha. So it's part of it. And they're either into it or they're not. And I don't like, I'm just thinking about like when I see someone in the world, it's not that instant for me. It has to be like, is that person or what they were doing or what they do hanging around in my mind? Am I telling it to people in my life in a way that like, oh, listen to this, you'll never believe what I learned about. Then I'll think, oh, maybe that's something that worth exploring. And it's never like, I'm going to write about that because I don't know what that is yet. I just know that there's something about that person or what they do that's literally awesome to me in the sense of like wondrous. And I want to find out more. So then I will approach them, either like I'll call or I'll email or I'll contact them on social media. And it'll be like, I'm a writer. Here's a link to what I've done before. I'm writing about, I'd like to write about you for blah, if it's like a short form piece in a publication, and then I'll send, you know, a little link to whatever that publication is, or I'm interested in, you know, catching up and talking to you a little bit more about this, potentially to write about. So it's like that. And they're either into it or they're not. So it self-selects a person that's kind of like into being written about, but I don't chase. So if they're not into it, they're not. I mean, it takes a lot of milk to make the cream. So yeah.
And as a relationship starts to evolve where you are with someone for periods of time, how do you see yourself as an observer? Is that what you're doing? Or how do you see what you're
I know. I mean, I see myself more like a very annoying, like child almost that they tolerate having around, because I mean, the nature of it, I think that awe is that I'm so out of place. I'm asking like what must be to them very remedial questions about what they do. And I mean, to the extent that I can see myself accurately, it's probably just like a companionably annoying person that's hanging around.
I think that's a great description. Is it awkward sometimes?
Yeah, very, very awkward. Extremely awkward. You just have to.
Can you think the most awkward kind of what is like one of the most awkward?
Probably like I'm thinking for the believer. There were like two like church visits that stood out in particular, the Mennonites at the first time I went to their church service, and then Revival Centers International, where they speak in tongues. And I went there a few times as well. And walking into, I think, any kind of group institutional settings, it's made easier in those instances because they're missionaries, like they're proselytizing, they want know strangers to come in. That's great. But it's also, I was very aware that this is something very holy, literally holy and personal and important to these people. And I don't, so I don't want to be seen to be kind of peering at them through a monocle or, you know, at taking any of it flippantly at all. And then, you know, I don't take kindly to being proselytized at. I mean, I'm kind of jolly about it, and I understand that's the contract I'm making by going in there. So I kind of have this very anti-authoritarian streak that I have to constantly push down so that my better self can just listen. And so it's all those things at once. And then also just, you know, I'm an ignorant. Like I'm new to that situation. Everything is new to me. And so I'm simultaneously really awkward and unsure if what I'm doing is offensive or weird. I'm trying my best. And at the same time, like the most alive because all details are new. And as a writer, that's just, it's not just a gift as a writer. It's for a person who wants to write factually about the world. It's the ideal situation. It's an utter gift to be, you know, in a place in this old world, in this old town that's utterly new to you, like a new undiscovered planet. And so it's all those things at once.
And so would you take notes in while being there, or do you just kind of live it and then remove and
generally I'm taking notes. I wish, like, this goes back to like the lawyerly or academic impulse versus reality of writing, is that's like, yes, I want to be taking note of everything. But I think there's two issues. Like, firstly, there's like the getting the details issue, where this opportunity is coming once, and you know, you might have more contact, but each opportunity of shared space and time, is something that you should respect and not fritter away. So I do want to take notes in that sense, and I will be kind of noting some stuff down, that those little golden details that to lose would be tragic. But there's a kind of the larger kind of sensory impulse, which is not something that you can take notes about. But as a general rule, unless it's, well, I can't even think of a situation where it would be like overtly offensive, but I try to visibly be taking notes just as a reminder to everyone around me that I'm there writing about it.
The people in your book, so I'm thinking of like Sandra in The Trauma Cleaner, Annie, Lynn, Katrina in The Believers, give a lot to you, but you also give a lot of yourself in these books. You are very vulnerable. Tell me why you think that's important.
Well, it's important for a number of reasons. It's in there because, well, firstly, that's how the interviews work. I mean, my interviews look mostly like I haven't done my homework. I will have, well, depending on, well, for these books, if it's a profile or kind of something more journalistic, I do go in with, you know, quite prepared questions. But for those books, the interviews were more circular and more conversational. So they'll be sharing with me things that I had not lived through. And indeed, I don't think many people have lived through, but I'll say, okay, I've experienced that feeling before. Is it like this? And so I think part of finding the emotional truth, which is what I'm interested in alongside the factual truth, involves that kind of energetic exchange, which involves kind of drawing on my own lived experience or lived emotional experience. And I also think it serves an ethical function in terms of, you know, the way I write, what I'm interested in. I'm asking fairly personal questions of them. And I think it just is, it has a better ethical energy if we're both doing it together. That's not always the case. Not always the case, not always possible, not always relevant, but where it is, that sort of conversation gets at a truth that you really can't get any other way. And then, you know, it serves a lot of technical, you know, in The Trauma Cleaner, it served, putting myself in there kind of served as a banister or railing, like a narrative through line, because I simply didn't have any other information to link certain chronology in Sandra's life. So I could put myself in there wondering or put myself in there reacting, which was also part of the story. So that was how it functioned there. In The Believer, I wanted to kind of structurally make the point that reflected what I was saying, what I was arguing for in the content, which was, you know, all of our actual practical experiences are very different, but we're all drawing on the same limited range of human emotions. And in that sense, what these people are experiencing is no different from what I too have experienced. And that is one of these stories as well. So, yeah, I mean, that's probably a long and confusing answer.
No, that's good. I think within the books, you also chart when you feel influenced by someone or kind of repelled by someone at certain points. You've said elsewhere, I'm telling the reader who I am so that they can accept or reject the filter with which I am processing the information. I like this idea of, well, I think it's important to be subjective about your own point of view. If you don't like how someone is being or disagree with them, how do you have ways of kind of reconciling that?
Like what do you mean? Like in the,
I mean, sort of on the page, like it's the thing about like life. If you don't like someone, you can think it in your head or you can walk away and talk to someone else about it. But if you're exploring that on the page, is there ever that desire to censor yourself?
Oh, I mean, well, yeah, it's a highly refined product by the finished draft. And like, you know, and so I've gone through various iterations of kind of conveying best what I felt, but I am limited to what I actually felt. And I have a kind of a merciless guilt button with that. So I am not using a reaction, not massaging a reaction to serve the purposes of what I'd like it to have been. I'm using my own emotions as, you know, factual material. And, but I'm trying, you know, within the bounds of fact to find the most kind of relevant way of making my reaction a part of the story. And ultimately, I may or may not like what somebody is saying, or I may or may not agree with what they're saying, but I'm listening because I think it's valuable. So that's kind of my guide.
Well, and you put it in, I suppose, too, don't you? Like, you are also giving them their voice.
Oh, yeah. Like, I try to, you know, I mean, it's difficult because the editing process and the selection process means that, you know, I am, you know, partial in what I put in. It's like I've said elsewhere, it's not, you know, the CCTV footage of life. It's a story of life. And so it's selective, and you can't put in every single detail, because then you wouldn't be writing about it. You'd be kind of just transcribing it. But again, you know, that guilt button, I'm not kind of, it would be much easier if you could kind of write the story that would, you think would work the best. I'm limited to the truth of the information, again, as I see it subjectively, but I have to be well with my, what ends up on the page. Is this what I believed they were saying? Is this what I believed they meant? And then what can be done with that? These are the issues.
There's a lot in your work that's very beautiful and very complex, but there's also a lot that can be quite dark or difficult to sit with. What are the hardest things for you to write about? Or maybe a different way is, like, how do you...
It's a great question. No, I'm just trying to think, because there's a lot of difficult things, but it's not often the things that the people think are going to be difficult. I had a piece in this edition of the Monthly on Richard Pusey, who filmed the four police officers as they were dying. And I write out that scene from the court judgments, like the factual findings in court. And people think, I've had a lot of feedback so far that that's the most brutal part and how brutal that must have been for me. But I think because I've read literally thousands of those cases, that's actually not the brutal part for me. That's just kind of what is. I mean, I'm moved by it. I think it's important, and I think it's horrifying and sad, but it's not kind of emotionally difficult in the way that most people assume that it would be, because I've had repeated exposure to it. The difficult part, like the most difficult part for me are the more emotionally quiet moments. So I'm thinking of Katrina's wake in The Believer. I procrastinated writing that up, which I don't normally procrastinate. I'm an exhausted mother of two very young children. And when I have the time to work, I am working. But I really sat on that material for much longer than I ever have with anything else, because I found it so incredibly distressing to write these little details, you know, what she was wearing, how she sat at the table. I could almost not bring myself to look at my notebook. So those little bits are incredibly distressing for me.
I can understand that. I struggled at a different emotional kind of timber with the sections on ghosts, because I'm very afraid of ghosts. Oh. And so what, I mean, you also read as having fear in those moments, but you are okay with it at the same time. Is the fear in those kind of more physical, sort of physical realms, is there an element of that that's fun to you?
Yeah, I mean, I was so scared. I was so surprisingly scared, like shocked at my own horror, like the hubris of thinking that I could go to these places and just simply observe. And then all of a sudden, like, the thing was, for the ghost research, I was pregnant. So I was exhausted, like it was the middle of the night both times. And, you know, I drink a lot of water at the best of times. So then inevitably I find myself having to go to the loo, which is a private business. You don't want to ask people that
And I'm rude in that.
I'm working with these people, like, to accompany me to the bathroom. It's absurd. So then you find yourself alone and having to deal with it. And the other thing is that, like, there's a draft of this book somewhere, which is just me being scared on the way to the loo. I mean, I had many other instances of it because there are many other ghost scenes from that research that I couldn't include in the book. So it was real for me in those times when I was alone. I guess that's the writerly thing, that it is both true that I was horrified and having to make the choice between being actually, like, really activated and scared and needing to go to the loo, but then you observe yourself and it is a hilarious situation.
In terms of research, so you do all this research, you have kind of people's stories and events and things. How do you make meaning of it?
So that's again like the push me, pull you between the training that I've had and the demands of creative practice. My impulse is to kind of do it harder. It's not working, so I'm going to do it harder. And I think, like, you would know probably that that's not how meaning is made for the purposes of books. So you kind of take in everything. It's either a question of having an idea or a vague sense of what you need to be writing about, doing the research, even starting. And I think we talk so much about the first draft, and I think that's bullshit. I think we need to be talking about a zero draft, because even the first draft puts so much pressure on ourselves. So, you know, you have all the material or you have the impulse. And then it really is this balance between sometimes doing it harder, in the case of a zero draft, and vomiting it out and getting something down that you can start working on. Or if you're not even able to do that yet, it's really kind of pulling back and letting all of those ideas and feelings percolate until that material is telling you what the story is. Because these are long games. And if what you thought you were writing about at the beginning is what you're writing about still years later, you've learned nothing about the process. And I think that you really have to know when to actually pull back, do it lighter, do it easier, do something else entirely, but while keeping that idea central enough at the back of the brain that all of the emotional information from the rest of your life and your reading and, you know, the newspaper and all of that is kind of going through that filter of that idea until something clicks enough, and then off you go. And then I think the second half is just about whittling and not refusing to kind of chase every rabbit down every hole and keeping, you know, central that small grain until it can become enough of its own story. But yeah, again, probably a long and confusing answer.
No, it's very useful.
I mean, is that how it worked for you? Like, I'm curious, like, I don't get to speak to a lot of writers.
I guess I was kind of thinking about fiction and nonfiction.
Oh, yeah.
And so I feel like for fiction, you have a sense of what you want to say to start out with. I mean, it may change a little bit, but you have a sense of what is important to you in a story, and you create or craft events to tell that. Whereas with this kind of nonfiction, it's like you have all the events and you in your head can feel there's a linkage between them, but that it's like working out what you think is a really tough.
But also I think being self-conscious enough to know why you were there in the first place. Why is that the story? Why was that the material you were drawn to? And it, like for me so far, and it's like this with anything over, probably anything over 4,000 words, 5,000 words, I'll think I'm writing about something. I'll go and get all the material, do all the interviews, and there'll be something or some topic that comes up again and again and again that I find deeply annoying and irrelevant and a waste of time. And I'll just like smile and nod through it and be like, oh, and then it'll be like, hold on, I think that's the story. And that's happened so many times now. And it's like this idea between like how much control you have and also how I think a process of getting to know yourself at a deeper and deeper level, and your motivations and your curiosities and your interests. But, you know, it's not anywhere near, like, it's not accessible to me in any real sense. It's really, I have to go through that type of a process every time.
That's interesting, though, that that repetition of something that is not inherently interesting to you, but you kind of have to at some point acknowledge that that is what is being said, you know?
Yeah, like, really listen. And like, put, I think that's what it means when I said that the material will tell you, because I mean, and again, like with fiction, I think it's also like the keeping alive, you have to exercise some control of keeping that world alive in your head. But at the same time, you're following, you know, the characters are talking to you. Like they're, and at a deeper level, that's just you talking to you. And so you have all this information, you have access to this information at a level that you don't even know about. This is so wanky. I don't like, I really, I believe it, but I listen to myself talking about like subconscious.
I love it. I'm totally into it.
It's only because I know that that's how it has worked, because, but I wouldn't necessarily in my actual life be like, oh, I have to listen to the material, but it's true. Like you do.
Well, it's even like that thing of the characters will tell you, like, it is you. Like, both are true, like, at the same time. To talk about writing, writers can be very precious. Are you plagued by doubt, like the rest of us?
Of course. I only have doubt. Like, I never, like, it's just dreadful. It's a dreadful process. And you never... You know, again, that replicability where kind of like in my other professional life, it's like, okay, so I've got to do this now and this is how I'm going to do it. And it's so much work, but it'll take approximately this long. And this is, and with everything I write, it's like, this is impossible. There's literally nothing new that can be said about this by anybody, and definitely not by me. How is it even going to work? I can't even conceive what I'm going to do here. With everything.
And so what do you tell yourself at those, in those moments? Or do you just press on?
I just press on. I just am like, well, there's just this like wet dread that just hangs over the whole process. But you do it. Like you do it, and then inevitably, you know, I think it's in the drafting, and I have many, many drafts that, you know, you're like, okay, this is good enough. This is something. It's not what I wanted to do. It's not what I had hoped for it to be, but, you know, good enough. And I think that good enough bit is like key to the, like, it's different. Like that's the difference between publishing something, well, publishing as a writer and not. It's just the acceptance that you're never going to do a perfect job or what you wanted. It's always going to be disappointing and less than ideal. And you can either kind of, you know, worry it into a lather forever, or you can publish and say that was the best I could do in the time that I had and move on to the next disappointment.
Well, you have actually had a lot of success with your work. What is the weirdest encounter you've ever had with a fan? There must be some.
Oh, there's been such deep weirdnesses. I'm very grateful to everyone who is misguided enough to want to see me in real life, and how disappointing that must be for them. But there was somebody at an event once who was smiling in a weird way the whole time, in a way that was like, I mean, for an hour. And I kept on trailing off because I was like, are they still smiling? And then I'd look and they're still smiling. And I was, do I know that person? Should I smile back? And then it would be like this weird, like, rictus as I tried to like look natural enough. I was like, are they going to harm me? Like, is that how this works? I don't know. I'm not very socially fluid at the best of times, but that was weird.
Sarah, we always like to get advice for other writers on this show. Is there something that you wish you knew when you were starting out?
Like, I think, firstly, there's a lot of there's a misunderstanding or kind of a false belief. And I think that we are even guilty of telling it to ourselves throughout a professional writing career. Like, it's something that you can easily sink back into. And that is, like, the idea that stories, I mean, I think it's true of fiction as well, like that it's just luck that you're not going to find a great story, and that it is, you know, oh, it's not going to come to you in this life, or you won't find it. But it's a way of looking at the world. And so it's like, you have to put on your story finding eyes, which are really just like your natural curiosity about ideas and people and places. Yeah, this is a case of doing it less, not doing it harder, just kind of being your actual self who loves to read and loves stories. And then you remember that there are more stories than there are people alive on Earth. And I think that takes a lot of the pressure off. So that's the first thing. And the second thing I think is just that kind of the zero draft, because it's something that I use in my head all the time. It's whenever there's kind of a discussion about writer's block or, you know, something, I think all of those kind of scary problems come down to a form of like crippling perfectionism. And my thesis supervisor, for my PhD is in a very tiny area of law.
Surprise.
but he's my only writing teacher, and he would be like, just vomit it out. And I always hear that, like, because how can you even hope to start working from nothing? If you have something on the page, even if you chuck out 99% of it, you'll have something to work from. And so I think all of those kind of hitting our heads against the keyboard and disappointments, it really does come down to these various like perfectionist tendencies. You're not going to write about everything to do with the idea. You're not going to, not everything is relevant or necessary. Not everything needs to be said perfectly, but you do need to start. So I'd say kind of just, if you think of it as like vomiting it out, you take so much pressure off and you can kind of find the joy again.
Well, it's a pretty low threshold, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of a low threshold.
Our last question, which I just realized I didn't give you a heads up on, is what is your favorite novel by a debut author?
Well, isn't it funny that when you, like, these questions come and it's like, I have never read a book before in my life.
Exactly.
Favorite book by a debut author? Well, oh gosh. So the one that's like most immediately coming to me is not an Australian writer, although I'm sure if I had more time, I could find many. But maybe it's because I was just talking about this book yesterday. Their name is Alex Marzano Lesnovich, and it's called Fact of a Body. And I know them from Adelaide Writers Festival when I was doing The Trauma Cleaner. So it was both of our first books. And it's a beautiful, it's nonfiction, and it's a beautiful exploration of a criminal case and their own journey through law school and their personal background. And it's a really good example of exploring one's own curiosity about the story and making it part of the story. They're just a masterful writer. So the fact that that was a debut was staggering to me. And so, yeah, that's the first one I can think of. I guess because I was talking to him the other day, I'm thinking of, I've got Bram Presser's The Book of Dirt, which was his debut, and it's fiction. But again, like, because I'm weird like this, it's not purely fiction. And I'm always interested in that kind of interleaving of, you know, a personal history, family history, how family histories are in their own way all fiction. And I think the way he managed to pull that all together is just beautiful.
Is that called docu-fiction in some ways? Like, because he's such an interesting, he does actually insert his own family story.
Yep. And that's where, you know, it started from, and that he's able to kind of, I mean, Bram's amazing to me because he's just kind of inhaled most of the literature of Earth. And so it's, you know, that those influences coming out and strong. In my fiction, like, I also, yeah, that's kind of where I gravitate towards naturally sometimes. I'm like kind of more Catholic in my taste, but I'm thinking the books that have made the strongest impact on me are stuff like Sebald's work, where you don't really know what's fact and what's fiction, and doesn't really matter in the sense that it's all an emotional truth at the end of the day. I don't apply that to my own writing. I have to come up against a very hard boundary of fact. Mm. But yeah, long answer, confusing. I'm sorry.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.